This is Radio Eco Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
Like it or not, we are the mind of the living world. We must now become its guardian and steward, to strive against the odds on behalf of all of life would be humanity at its most noble. We can share this precious planet of ours. All life can prosper. This is my dream.
Are you worried that beloved creatures are disappearing? So how can we save the rest of nature? There's a lot of talk about that. In 2017, the famous biologist E.O. Wilson proposed the book Half Earth, and he was suggesting we reserve half the planet for wild things if we want to avoid that sad and dangerous time when species go extinct. The idea has been refined into the Global Deal for Nature, but now a group of European scientists questions how that could work. Dr. Chris Sandbrook is a co-author of the paper Protecting Half of the Planet Could Directly Affect Over 1 Billion People. It was published in Nature Sustainability in November 2019. Sandbrook is a senior lecturer at Cambridge and oversees a master's program in conservation leadership. Chris Sandbrook, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, a lot of us do fear that things around us may disappear slowly or unnoticed. It's a kind of eco-anxiety. Do you feel that?
Yes, I absolutely do. And I think it's a real problem that we face in conservation is something that we call shifting baseline syndrome, which is this idea that every generation experiences a different and an increasingly depleted ecology that they grow up with. So when we think back to our childhood about how things used to be, that's what I think of is going to be different to what my parents thought of or what my grandparents thought of. And so we kind of think that things aren't changing so much when actually they're changing a lot. And we do experience anxiety as we see things disappearing around us. It can be very damaging to our mental health.
So in answer to these concerns, how much of the world's land and sea have major governments agreed to set aside for the preservation of nature?
So the current set of targets which governments around the world have committed to under the Convention for Biological Diversity is a terrestrial target of 17%. Of coverage and a marine target of 10%, and the target there was by 2020, so by next year. And on land, we're not far off hitting that target. I believe the current figure is somewhere around about 15%. And in the oceans, we're a little bit further behind, but making quite rapid advances as more and more countries are declaring marine protected areas. So I think there's some possibility of hitting those numbers, although I'm not tracking it by the minute.
And would biologists and specialists think that that is enough?
Well, no would be the straightforward answer for most people. I think, however, the big caveat to that is a lot of it depends on how these areas are actually looked after. So one of the problems we face at the moment is a kind of focus just on a number. So this idea that, you know, we need to have a particular number that we aim for. And actually, a lot of the issues are really around how land is being managed. So a lot of protected areas are not really very well protected in practice. But also, I think we need to think about all the areas that are outside protected areas and what we can do to try to conserve biodiversity in farmland and in cities and in, you know, basically everywhere on Earth, rather than just focusing on a, you know, a small proportion of the planet.
So how would you describe the Global Deal for Nature?
Well, so the Global Deal for Nature, as I understand it, and I won't claim, you know, it's not my idea, so I won't claim I can speak about it with great authority, is a plan which has been put forward to try to conserve biodiversity over the coming decades by scaling up radically the current coverage of protected areas on land and in the sea, and also by trying to tackle some of the underlying drivers of biodiversity loss in things like agriculture and the overconsumption of fish species and so on that we have a problem with at the moment.
And as a senior lecturer at Cambridge, do you think the numbers behind this idea of half are solid scientifically? I mean, maybe we really need two-thirds, or maybe we need much less than that. Do we know?
Well, I think there are two sides to answering that question. One is sort of technical, and the other is more about underlying value. So if your starting point is that, you know, we want to avoid losing any species, or we want to, you know, achieve certain goals in terms of climate change and so on, then you can certainly make a good argument from biogeography and other kind of conservation science that half may be a bit bigger to aim at. But I think you also need to think about that in terms of the underlying values, as I said. So some people have that as their top priority, is avoiding extinction of any species. Other people are more concerned or equally concerned about other important issues facing us as a society, issues around about environmental justice and equity for different people. And I think once you bring these different factors into play, then what looks like the right answer may start to look a little bit different.
Well, we're going to discuss eco-justice more in just a minute, but if the Global Deal for Nature was implemented, as suggested by Eric Dinnerstein's group, how many more humans would be affected by that?
Well, so the analysis which we have done in the paper which we've just published looks at what would happen if half of all eco-regions in the world were put into protected areas, and eco-regions are... There are several hundred ecoregions which define different categories of habitat, different types of ecosystems that we find on the planet. If we put half of all of those into protected areas to achieve that half Earth ambition, our analysis suggests that you would end up with over 1 billion people living in the areas, or who currently live in the areas, that would then be in protected areas. And so the big question then is, what would happen to those people? Would they be able to continue living in those places? And if not, where would they go? And if they could continue to live in those places, how would their lives be affected by the kind of new introduced protections that would come with that deal? Now, the Global Deal for Nature, as it stands at the moment, is not aiming for the 50% target. It's aiming for a 30% target, but as a kind of milestone on the track towards a 50% target in the future. So we haven't actually done the analysis at this stage that looks at the 30% target and what the impact of that would be, but I think we can assume it would be proportionally smaller than what we found in our study, but nonetheless a significant and likely impact on the people who are residents in those areas. And I think just to say, it's really important to stress that in our study, we're not saying or collectively saying this is necessarily a terrible thing. I think what we're trying to do is simply call attention to the very real issue of these are large numbers of people who are living their lives in the way they are at present, and we need to think really carefully about what would happen to such people if this kind of plan were to be implemented. Clearly, achieving conservation goals is going to require some quite major action to be taken, and it's going to cause opportunities and costs for lots of different people. But we really need to understand the kind of scale of the social impacts that we're considering before we can make some informed choices about the way forward.
Well, a 2018 paper led by Zia Marabi talked about the possible agricultural losses. She was talking 15 to 31% of crop land and 14 to 45% of pasture land, and a lot of food calories from crops could be lost if half the Earth's terrestrial ecoregions were given back to nature. And I could see that as prohibitive, and so we can't do it, too much loss of food for humanity, or we could read those numbers as a measure of the size of our over-encroachment on nature already. Are we past some limits, and do we know even where those limits are?
Yes, it's a very interesting study, the one that you mentioned, and I think I see it as our piece is, in a sense, kind of a natural progression from that piece of research. They were looking at food specifically, and we're looking at the kind of population numbers involved in the impact that might be felt. Yeah, your question is a very good one, and in a sense almost impossible to answer. I mean, we're on a trajectory towards a population size which is going to be very challenging for the planet to support in a sustainable way and without a considerable loss of biodiversity. I don't think it's impossible that we can support a larger population than we have at present, but I think it's really very urgently requiring attention to the consumption levels we have in the West. I think if we're going to be able to sustain a larger human population on Earth, then we need to radically degrow and downscale our economies in the countries like the US and Canada and the UK, where we and many of your listeners are based. At the same time, I was thinking about what we can do to conserve biodiversity in largely tropical countries where so much of it is found. So I think we can't possibly talk about radically scaling up protection in the global south without simultaneously radically scaling down demand in the global north. To do anything else would be just frankly unfair.
Right. And you talk about in the paper, if we were very strict about saving every ecozone, then we would have to turn a part of London into a conservation area. I don't think anybody suggested that, but it is interesting to think about that as an idea. Perhaps part of London could become a conservation area, and how we would have to green cities to be part of this program.
Yeah, so that was just an interesting thing that came out of our analysis. So when we were looking at, well, the process that we took was to say if we allocated additional land within each eco-region to get up to that 50% target, we did that in a way that tried to minimize the human footprint index score for the areas that we added. And so we were trying to do it in a way that would have the minimum possible impact on people and then see how many people lived in those areas. As it turned out, in the eco-region in southeast England, the last pixel that was allocated in that process was an area of London. And you're right, I think that was probably more of an artifact of problems with the Human Footprint Index map than any kind of, you know, there are clearly other places in southeast England that would be more obviously sensible to create protected areas. But I think it does nonetheless help to illustrate the fact that, you know, we're not talking here about large tracts of, you know, relatively intact forest somewhere with a, you know, a small population of indigenous people living in them. We are talking about really seriously populated areas like the southeast of England. Just to come to the second part of your point, though, about whether we need to think about conservation in urban areas, well, certainly we do. I think there's a lot of interesting work going on in that space and a lot of value that people can get for their mental health and well-being from having opportunities to access nature in urban areas. Those places will rarely contain rare and endemic species, which are of a very high priority from a biodiversity conservation point of view, but they can nonetheless be hugely valuable for resident people. And there is actually a proposal to convert London into, or to brand London as a national park city, which I think, you know, conservation purists might raise an eyebrow or two at what that means in practice, because clearly it's a very large, you know, global metropolis. But there is a lot of concern about conservation in London, and it's quite a green city, and they want to kind of claim it as a national park city.
So as your paper acknowledges, some nature preserves have benefited local people, and I think of marine conservation areas, which then spawned a bigger catch for commercial fishers in the long run. Is it accurate to say that most of the resistance to setting nature aside comes from local people rather than the broad electorate?
Yes, I think that is fair. I mean, I agree with you that there are some really positive examples where protecting nature in protected areas can be beneficial to local people, and some marine protected areas are a great example of that. But unfortunately, there are many examples where creating protected areas is harmful to resident populations and is resisted. So many examples of people being evicted or displaced, either physically or economically, you know, to make way for the protected areas, and losing access to livelihoods or to traditional lands and cultural sites and so on. So very often the resistance to conservation does come from the local level, and that's often because it's local people who tend to bear the highest cost of conserving areas, which whereas the benefits are spread much more widely. So, you know, I feel a benefit from the fact that there are tigers being protected in India because I care about tigers, but I don't have to live with the cost of tigers, you know, being protected in my neighborhood in terms of lost access to land or the risk of being attacked by a tiger. So it's that uneven distribution of costs and benefits which is kind of a profoundly challenging problem for conservation, because it creates concerns about justice and fairness.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
This is Radio EcoShock, speaking with Dr. Chris Sandbrook from the University of Cambridge about a global deal for nature. And you do feel strongly about eco-justice, Chris. Why?
Well, okay, so I think just on terminology, there are various different language for these things flying around. So what I personally care a lot about is what I would call environmental justice, which is really about trying to make sure that conservation is done in a way which is fair to often poor and marginalized people who have historically suffered at the hands of conservation in many cases. And, you know, conservation has its origins in kind of colonial policies that were implemented, you know, often against people like Native American people who were evicted to make way for the first national parks in the United States, or indigenous people in East Africa who were evicted to make way for protected areas there by the British colonial government. So I have a kind of deep-seated concern for justice and fairness for those people in environmental terms. I see eco-justice as being a slightly different flavor of this concern for justice, and this is more related to interspecific justice, so the question of whether it's fair for humans to cause harm to non-humans for our own benefit, and a kind of increasing sensitivity to the possibility that we should be allocating rights or thinking about non-human life in a similar way to how we think about human life as something that, you know, where fairness comes into account, which, you know, I think is a really important consideration that we have to also bear in mind.
Yes, I think species, and this is just my personal opinion, like the orangutan or the koalas, do have a right to exist, and that we may have to make human sacrifices in order to do it. But I see your point that it's easy for you and I talking on a radio in rich countries to say, well, somebody in a jungle should move out or not be able to cut down the trees that they need because we feel strongly about those animals. So it's a very tough problem to solve.
It is exactly that. And you know, there are examples where conservation can be done in a way which is more respectful to local rights, and there's a whole kind of community conservation movement. There's a lot of attention now on giving local and indigenous people the right to manage and control land which they may wish to look after in a way which is beneficial for biodiversity. And you know, one of the areas where I think there is agreement between myself and the authors of the Global Deal for Nature is exactly that. They're very keen on the idea of the protection of indigenous lands and giving indigenous people the right to manage those lands, and I would support that. Where I kind of get a bit concerned about it is I think the analysis that we have done shows that the kind of scale of the social impact really exceeds what we might think of as indigenous lands, which are largely intact and with very low population densities of people. Many of these places that would need to be protected to achieve that Half Earth vision are really much more intensely used and converted lands where people are living, you know, in a way that most of us wouldn't recognize as, you know, indigenous people in the normal way of thinking of that.
So in the end, does your group sort of come out against the Global Deal for Nature, or do you have modifications? I think you had three recommendations.
So the thing that we really are asking for in our study is for a little bit more clarity from the people who are proposing the Half Earth Plan or the Global Deal for Nature about exactly where they are asking for new protected areas to be created and what kind of protection they're advocating. Because one of the areas which is crucially important for understanding these proposals is how strict are we talking when we look at these protected areas? Are they very strict national parks in which no people can live or work, or are they somewhere on the spectrum down to much less restricted protected areas in which people can live, or through to indigenous lands which can be owned and managed by indigenous people, as I was just describing. And that makes a massive difference to how we understand the feasibility and the potential impact of this proposal. Because if we are talking about half the world in very, very strict, you know, wilderness areas, that is going to have an enormous impact on society and be very, very difficult to get global governments to agree to. But on the other hand, if we're talking about a wide range across that whole spectrum, that becomes a much more feasible plan, a much less risky plan, in my opinion, and one that, you know, I'd actually be willing to contemplate supporting. So that's a big part of what we're recommending, is for a bit more clarity about what's really being asked for. And then we're also asking for the parties that are negotiating the Convention on Biological Diversity post-2020 plan, which will be agreed in China in October of 2020. We're asking them to really think a bit more holistically about understanding what all the social implications of protected areas might be, and to make sure that the plan they come up with isn't just fixated with a big scaling up of the global protected area estate, but also looks really seriously at the underlying drivers of biodiversity loss in the industrialized north.
And there you are talking about production and consumption, and I agree with you 100%. As long as we continue to eat up the resources of the world, it's hard to see how we'll protect any of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of fairness, you know, you just made the point a moment ago about, you know, it's easy for us to be here, you know, talking from our positions of privilege, relative privilege in the world, whilst, you know, people that I used to work with in rural Uganda, you know, really suffering the consequences of living outside a protected area which is conserving mountain gorillas for the global good. And I feel much more comfortable about the idea that we might, as a global society, ask those people to make some sacrifices on our behalf to keep those species alive, if we are also willing to make those sacrifices or a different kind of sacrifice in our own lives, which might mean changing the food we eat, it might mean changing the car we drive, it might mean flying less, it might mean voting for and lawmakers who are going to take action on these issues. So I feel that having that balance is what gives conservation some legitimacy to ask for actions elsewhere in the world.
Are there other alternative sort of plan B being advanced by a broad coalition of conservation groups or academics or international institutions? Do we have other ways of going if we don't go this way?
Well, I'm not sure that there's another kind of big, glamorous plan in quite the same way as there is with the Global Deal for Nature. I think various people feel that we can carry on with a kind of incremental growth in the protected area estate, really focusing on investing in what we've got and making sure that it works, and tackling the underlying drivers of biodiversity loss in a way that could be as or even more effective for conservation than going for these big jumping forward targets. I published a paper a few years ago with some other colleagues in which we called for what we called whole earth instead of half earth. And this was really arguing that rather than keeping pushing for these big numbers, we should also be thinking about the kind of production side the consumption side of the global economy, which we've just been discussing. And one of the other points we made in that paper is there's a big problem, in my view, with this language of us and them. So half earth, kind of half the nature, half the people, just really reinforces this linguistic discursive divide between humans on the one hand and nature on the other. And I believe, as I think we all do when we stop and think about it, that people are part of nature. And I think we need to come up with a much more integrated vision for how we can live on Earth and share it with other species, of which we are a part of these systems. So I get quite worried about this notion of humans in one place and nature everywhere else. I don't feel like that's a sustainable plan to aim for.
I do admit, Chris, I was a little worried that your paper might stoke doubts and caveats that are used by countries all too easily to stall or evade the really strong measures that we need to save the natural world. Do you have those concerns as you worked on this?
Well, yeah, I suppose I wouldn't say I had those concerns in doing this work, because I genuinely felt that it was really important to answer this question. And actually going into this research, I really had no idea what the number would be that we came out with. I just thought it was a very important piece of information for the conservation community and the policy community to have to hand. I do worry, actually, that going for a really big, radical kind of half-earth plan might actually completely backfire for conservation. So, as someone who cares about conservation, I think we need a plan that is going to work politically and socially and ecologically. And if we go for a very radical plan, which could be implemented in a very heavy-handed way, I worry that that would completely undermine any future support for conservation and could actually undermine conservation success. So I don't see this work, I don't see this work as taking a position very strongly one way or the other about the Global Deal for Nature. I see it as a useful context for those discussions. But also I think if we did go for a very, very strong and kind of high-end ask, I worry that it won't work out well for conservation in the long term. And as someone who does care about conservation, I would be disappointed about that.
Yes, and you've been on the ground to see it. So what is a political ecologist, and why did you go in that direction?
Sure. So I started out as a conservation scientist. My undergraduate degree and my master's degree were both in zoology and conservation science. And I then increasingly came to the realization that conservation is fundamentally a human issue and a social issue. So if we're going to address the impact that people are having on nature, on non-human nature, we need to understand people and processes that are social and political at heart. So I went and studied for my PhD in anthropology. I went and looked at the impact of tourism on mountain gorillas and local people living around a national park in Uganda. And from there, I've ended up in geography, and I now see myself most closely associated with a field called political ecology. And political ecologists are interested in the relationship between people and their non-human environment, and particularly how that relationship is shaped by political and economic forces. So things like the way in which we organize our economy, so under capitalism or under alternative forms of management, and how issues kind of interact across multiple scales to shape the things that we see happening on the ground. So in a sense, it's trying to take the really big picture to understand what is going on at the local scale. So rather than just looking at okay, you know, these people are cutting down these forests. What can we do to stop that happening? We tried to ask ourselves, you know, why are these people cutting down the forest, and how is that shaped by historical factors, by economic factors, by cultural factors? And in so doing, I think political ecologists are able to shed a lot of very useful light to help us understand, you know, what some of the problems are that we're facing in conservation, and occasionally, although not always, offer some useful suggestions for how we could improve that situation.
And as we wrap up, could you tell us about some of the conservation leaders you have helped train at the specialized master's program at Cambridge and maybe where they are now?
Yeah, sure, be happy to. So we established the master's in 2010, and it trains established professional conservationists from around the world. So we've now had students from over 80 different countries across those first 10 years, and we give them applied leadership and management skills as well as cutting-edge interdisciplinary academic training. And they work with a whole group of conservation charities that are based with us in Cambridge in England as part of their studies. And they are going on to, you know, really important roles in both governments and in the charity sector and in the private sector. Just as a couple of examples, we have one of our students, alumna from Guyana, is now the Deputy Commissioner of Protected Areas for Guyana in South America. We have several students who are in leadership roles in international charities working in Eastern and Southern Africa. They're really going off to make a big difference for conservation, and it's absolutely wonderful to see them going out and putting into practice what we've helped them with during their studies.
From the University of Cambridge, we've been speaking with Dr. Chris Sandbrook, and I will put links to the paper we've been talking about in my show blog, and you can find updates from time to time from Chris Sandbrook in the blog thinkinglikeahuman.wordpress.com. Chris, thank you for sharing your time with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Now I'd like to finish by reading the final paragraph of my book, Half Earth. We should forever bear in mind that the beautiful world that our species inherited took the biosphere 3.5 billion years to create. The intricacy of the species we know only in part, and the way they work together to create a sustainable balance we have only recently begun to grasp. Like it or not, prepared or not, we are the minds and the stewards of the living world. Our own ultimate future depends upon that understanding. We have come a very long way through the barbaric period in which we still unfortunately live. And now I believe we've learned enough to adopt a transcendent moral precept concerning the rest of life on this planet. It's easy to say, do no further harm to the biosphere. Thank you.